Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Bratfeld, Judge Jessen. The Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated. Morning. Our first case this morning is 823-0875, the State of Minnesota versus, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Seneca Steep Rock. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So, counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready, you can approach the microphone and the podium and adjust it to your level, and just please begin by telling us who you are. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I represent the appellant, Seneca Steep Rock. This court must reverse Mr. Steep Rock's convictions because the evidence against him was obtained in violation of his constitutional rights, was inadmissible hearsay, and because the jury instructions were inadequate. I'd like to begin with the DNA issue, which is the second issue in our brief. Sticking a Q-tip in someone's mouth to take a saliva sample for DNA testing is a search under the Fourth Amendment and under the Minnesota Constitution. That we know that from this court's decision in CTL, from the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in JWK, which involves a blood sample, not a Q-tip, but same principle, and from the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in State versus Hardy, which held that even requesting that someone open their mouth is a search under both the federal and state constitutions. And of course, the United States Supreme Court in Schmerber and a long line of other cases has held the same thing. Searches require a warrant supported by probable cause or an exception to the constitutional warrant requirement. There's no exception to the warrant requirement at issue here, none that the state has asserted. And there is no search warrant supported by probable cause that authorized this search. Instead, the search was purportedly authorized by Rule 9 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure. But Rule 9, by its on the face of it, doesn't authorize an unconstitutional action. Rule 9 itself says that any action taken must be, quote, subject to constitutional limitations. And Rule 9 does not require probable cause for taking of a saliva sample.
So, Mr. Butler, if I could just ask about your constitutional analysis here. So are you arguing, I mean, I saw a heading in your brief, but are you arguing that Minnesota law in this regard, constitutional law, diverges from federal law here, is more protective of the constitutional rights at issue? Because I didn't see that fleshed out in your briefing, and I want to understand what's before us.
Absolutely, Your Honor. So no, we're not making an argument that Minnesota law is more protective than federal law. The CTL decision that says that this type of action is a constitutional search requiring a probable cause-based warrant was based both on the federal and the state constitution, sort of equally. So this isn't a case where the federal constitution would allow something and the state constitution then doesn't, at least not as far as I read the case law. It will say that both sources of authority were cited to the district court and are cited in our brief. So if you feel like you need to get there, we can talk about that. But I don't think that's really an issue here.
So, counsel, help me out. This Rule 9 that you're talking about also authorizes a district court to order a defendant or appellant, in this case the appellant, to provide fingerprints, handwriting samples. So explain your reasoning, and you please use the case law, if preferable, on why these things are different. You obviously are, you're claiming that it is, right? Yeah.
And the difference...
And it's a saliva sample as opposed to a Q-tip in the mouth, right? I mean, that may have been what happened here, but isn't that right?
That's the way to get a saliva sample. That's how they take a DNA sample for DNA testing.
So it's not possible to do it. I mean, my physician occasionally asks me to do it in different ways. I'm just curious.
Here we're talking about a Q-tip in the mouth because that's how the phrase here is buccal swab. So a bugle.
Is that what the statute says?
It's not what the rule says, but that's what the state requested in this case. The state requested a bugle swab. And the reason they requested a bugle swab was to test for DNA. And a bugle swab is sticking a Q-tip in someone's mouth and taking a sample of the saliva and everything else that's on the cheek.
I got that. So I'm sorry, I'd like to go back to the legal question if you
don't
mind.
Sure, of course. Yeah. The difference between the things, Your Honor, is that some things are constitutional searches and some things are not.
With or without this exception to the warrant requirement?
Correct.
Okay,
so
go for it.
Taking a fingerprint, for example, is not a Fourth Amendment search. You don't need a warrant or a warrant exception to take someone's fingerprint. You don't. The classic example that's authorized by the rule is a physical lineup, which is something that we don't see very much anymore. But the rule says the judge can make the defendant participate in an actual lineup. Right. That's not a search.
But going back to fingerprints, so is that distinction has been recognized in, you know, on a constitutional basis, both federally and in Minnesota?
I believe the United States Supreme Court has held that taking a fingerprint is not a search. I can double check on that.
No, you don't need to double check. I'm just trying to, you know, you're asking us to parse the statute, right, and carve out something specific to this saliva sample or buccal swab, right? And so I'm just trying to get you to point me to the case law that says that that's exactly what we should do.
The case law that says that's exactly what you should do, Your Honor, is the line of cases I started at the beginning with that say that taking a buccal swab for DNA testing is a constitutional search, and when you have a search, it requires a probable cause-based warrant. There is no case law in Minnesota for the proposition that the police can take a buccal swab from someone without who's not been, you know, like we're not talking about convict searches or whatever, who hasn't been convicted of a crime, absent a probable cause-based search or some sort of warrant exception.
Right, and I understand that this is the cases that you're pointing to, I think, are all searches prior to charges, right? And you briefed the question as to whether probable cause at that stage, so a search prior to charges, is different from a search post-charges, which is where we are here.
I believe...
I'm using that term search because you have.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I believe that CTL had been charged.
Oh, okay.
Because that's one of the state's argument in CTL was, well, there was probable cause to support the charge, and therefore we could go in and take this buccal sample. And this court, opinion by Judge Peterson, rejected that and said probable cause for the charge is different than probable cause to go in and take the buccal sample. And so here, yes, we have, he's been charged, but of course, as this court recognized in CTL, he's presumed innocent of this charge. And so what the government needs to take a DNA sample is a warrant. And of course, in this case, the state tried at first to use a warrant. They got a warrant and took a DNA sample, except that warrant was unconstitutional. And so the state said, never mind, we won't use that sample from our unconstitutional warrant. We're just going to try again with this Rule 9 order.
What do we do with the U.S. Supreme Court's case in King dealing with the collection of DNA
and
buccal swabs, right?
So
I mean, you aren't distinguishing, right, between Minnesota and federal law on this?
I'm not necessarily. I think King, the difference, and the reason the state in this case has not cited, I don't believe King is cited in their brief. They haven't.
I don't think we can ignore it.
Well, I don't think you can ignore. I agree.
Okay, thank
but
you.
The reason I think it's not cited is because King is about something called the special needs doctrine, which has to do with government actions that are not law enforcement based. So the sample that's taken in King is not to produce evidence of a crime. It is to identify the defendant to basically to make sure they've got the right guy in custody. So when they say, we have Mr. King, then we get a DNA sample, we compare it to something, and we say, yep, that's Mr. King in custody. Here, and the U.S. Supreme Court distinguished between that situation and a situation in a case called City of Charleston, an older case where the government was taking DNA or drug test results in that case from new mothers so that they could prosecute them for drug abuse. And the theory there was, no, we're just trying to protect the child, and
it's
this is a really
test?
Tough protection
I'm sorry.
Issue. Say again?
A blood test in that case?
I believe it was a blood test, yes.
Okay, all right.
And a blood test is a search, just like a buccal swab is a
search. I understand. You've been around a long time, Mr. Butler. So, I mean, our case law has differentiated among certain types of samples, notably in the DWI area, right? Blood, breath. Now we're talking about saliva, buccal swabs. So I'm just trying to work through the line. And if sure. you're saying that King relies on case law dealing with blood tests, is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that the purpose is the difference.
Okay.
The purpose of the search. Mm-hmm. The purpose of the search in this case is very clear. The state is very obvious about it. It is to compare the DNA from Mr. Steeprock to DNA found on the gun so that they can prosecute Mr. Steeprock for this murder. It is not for some quote-unquote special need utterly divorced from law enforcement, which is what King is about. In CTL, yes. this court held, quote, the state, quote, taking and analyzing biological specimens, parentheses, is a search under the Fourth Amendment. In Schmerber versus California, United States Supreme Court explained, when the state directs that a biological specimen be taken from a person and analyzed, that is a search under the Fourth Amendment. And so once you have a search, you need a warrant. And there's nothing for example, look at the rule. The rule itself says, well, you need probable cause to take a blood sample. And this rule, which has existed as far back, I traced it back to 1980, and I think it's existed whenever the rules of criminal procedure were first promulgated, but at least in 1980, well before we had DNA testing. But we did have blood testing for things in 1980, and so the drafters of the rule in 1980 said, well, yeah, you're going to need probable cause to take a blood sample because the U.S. Supreme Court has this case about blood samples. They didn't say that for saliva because we weren't testing saliva for DNA in 1980. But what they did say in the rule itself is that the test has to comply with constitutional limitations. And so the question here is not whether the rule is constitutional or anything like that. The rule bakes the Constitution into its plain text. And so the question here is whether this search was supported by a probable cause-based warrant or a warrant exception, and the answer is that it was not. I did want to clarify one thing about the record, if I may. On respondent's brief, on page 19, paragraph 2, says, quote, Judge Beers found a, quote, fair probability, end quote, that a buccal swab would show evidence of a crime. There's no citation to the record after that sentence because that is not true. Judge Beers did not make any such finding. The word fair probability or phrase does not appear in her oral order or in her written order. The only finding the judge makes and the only finding the state asked her to make was this materially aid finding that is required by the rule. And materially aid is not probable cause. We know that from two things. One, we know that the rule specifies that you need probable cause for a blood sample. So the rule wouldn't say that if probable cause and materially aid were the same thing. Number two, materially aid is about the utility of the fruits of the search. Probable cause is about the likelihood that incriminating evidence might be found. And so the whole point of the rule is that you don't need probable cause for a whole bunch of things that are not searches, like fingerprints and lineups. On the prejudice analysis to this, you know, there are really two major buckets of evidence that the state presented. One was the hearsay statements of the co-defendant, which I'd love to get into in my last couple minutes. The other was this. But this evidence, for this evidence, I think either one of them alone is enough to reverse. And in particular, this evidence, because the state bears the burden here of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that this unconstitutionally obtained evidence did not impact the jury's decision. And I just don't think you can look at this record and say that the defendant's evidence that the defendant's DNA is on the murder weapon or the attempted murder weapon didn't impact the jury's decision. Of course it did. And for that, you can look no further than the prosecutor's closing argument. There are six separate pages where the prosecutor relies on the DNA evidence. The most evocative is at page 560 when she rhetorically asks, oh, did Mr. Steeprock's DNA just happen to be on the Taurus that shot a bunch of times at Mr. Jones? At 561, she says to the jury, it's the last thing she says to the jury in rebuttal closing. She says, boy, if you don't really think that's his DNA, then you better acquit him. So, of course, the implication being if you think it is his DNA, it's a different result.
So, Mr. Butler, that leads to my next question, which is, if we agree with you on the other two issues but not on the Rule 9 issue, you know, then we have this DNA evidence, and didn't that, can't we say that other errors, if made, would not have impacted the jury's verdict, given just what you said about the DNA evidence?
No, Your Honor. I think our argument's going to continuum, and I agree with you that the prejudice analysis on the instruction issue is probably a bit of an uphill battle. The hearsay issue, though, that's a big chunk of the state's case. Otherwise, you have him being one of like 12 people whose DNA is on that gun with no other real connection. But when she, you know, the prosecutor's closing, she also plays in great detail for long periods of time lengths of those recordings of Ms. Cutbank talking about Mr. Steeprock. And so, again, we're talking about impact. And it's not a question of if you remove one piece of evidence, is there still enough, you know, or would the jury have still convicted him without this piece of evidence? That's not the test under either test, under any of the tests. The test is always about impact. And what was the impact of the wrongfully admitted evidence at this trial on this jury's decision? For the constitutional issue, the state bears the burden. For the evidentiary issue, I do. That's a difference. But either way, this trial was based on those two things. And both of them had a tremendous impact on the jury's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. You will have rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Ragatz. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent respondent in the state of Minnesota in this matter. I'm eager to answer any questions the court has on any of these issues out of the gate. There are 6 points I'd like to make in response to appellant's reply brief and what he's argued today. And I'll jump into the first one, unless this court has an immediate question, because the first one goes to all of the issues. And that is, any error here was harmless because the evidence was overwhelming. And I've cited cases on page 10 of my brief that indicate overwhelming evidence is enough to render any error harmless. You don't have to go through a 5-point test. If you have overwhelming evidence of guilt, that is enough to establish harmlessness. And we have that here. We've got the DNA.
The appellant's brief cites the case law that suggests that we need to look at the impact of the evidence that was admitted in error. And that it's not enough, or maybe, let's put it this way, the Supreme Court is considering whether it's appropriate to, in determining the impact, also look at the weight of the other evidence, which to me, when you use that word overwhelming, which again, it comes from our case law, right? It sounds to me like you're asking us to weigh the other evidence instead of look at the impact of the erroneously admitted evidence. Does my question make sense?
It does, Your Honor. I understand it, and I think the language here is a little odd because the case law says it has to have had an effect on the verdict. Well, the only possible effect evidence can have on a verdict is making it guilty when it would otherwise have been not guilty, or vice versa. This isn't
well,
like
that's why I'm asking you to talk about impact.
Right, but that's okay. But I think that goes to impact because if the impact isn't to change it from guilty, not guilty, or vice versa, then there's no effect on the verdict, and there has to be an effect on the verdict. It's different in the civil arena. In the civil arena, maybe the verdict would have been $100,000 instead of $80,000. There could be a range. But here, there's only two choices, guilty or not, which not could be hung, too. But so the only possible impact or effect is changing the verdict from one to the other. And there is case law from the Minnesota Supreme Court where they have basically said, the evidence here is overwhelming, therefore it was harmless error. Because if the evidence is overwhelming, there's no impact.
I read your brief, though, counsel, to say, and maybe I'm wrong, that if we agree with the appellant that the hearsay evidence was erroneously admitted and agree with the appellant on the Rule 9 issue, then Mr. Seaprock's entitled to
I've conceded that in my brief. Okay. If we lose on both hearsay and DNA, then it has to go back. But if we lose on just one of the two,
Mr. Ragatz, then you're saying even if we didn't have the DNA, he'd be convicted based on the jailhouse conversations. Would that be a fair statement?
Not just the jailhouse conversations. I think there's five key critical pieces of evidence here. And again, if you take away both the DNA and the calls, we lose. But if you just take away one of the other five, we don't lose. And the five are the DNA. That's obviously quite strong. The appellants conceded that's overwhelmingly strong. You also have the fact that he fled the police when he was found with the other shooter, with the victim's car, 2 days after the murder. Sorry, the attempted murder. So that shows consciousness of guilt. That's number two. Three, we've got the fact that he had the gun with his DNA on it. So that the DNA isn't the only tie between him and the gun. It was found in a snowbank where his hand had just been not that long before. And it was recovered after these jailhouse calls indicating that he ditched it. And that's how they found it, the snowbank. So you've got that. That's number three. I think that's number four, because you've got the DNA, you've got the fleeing, the gun being in his presence, and then you've also got the fact that the other shooter identifies him in these calls as her accomplice. So you put all these things together, the consciousness of guilt, et cetera, and even if you didn't have the DNA, there's no other rational explanation for the gun used in the shooting, we know that from the ballistics, being with him, with the other shooter, with the victim's car, 2 days after the shooting. So that's where, even if you take away the impact of the DNA or the impact of the calls, you still have enough. There's no reasonable possibility the jurors would have ignored the rest of this evidence and found him not guilty.
So, refresh my recollection, who saw him throw the gun in the snowbank?
No one did, but the police chased him. They apprehended him with his hand in a snowbank. They go back to that snowbank, and there's the gun.
Right, but after... I mean, would it be a fair statement this was the first time the dog couldn't find it the first time, and then the dog found it the second time?
Well, the first time they had an explosive-sniffing dog, after the jailhouse call, they brought back a gun-sniffing dog, and the gun-sniffing dog found the gun right where appellant was. And there's never been any other sort of innocent explanation for how the gun got there or why he had the gun used in the shooting 2 days later with the other shooter. And we knew he had a tie to the other shooter, regardless of these jailhouse phone calls, and the victim's car, again, not long after the shooting.
And how long before they brought the right dog to the scene? Like that day, the next day?
Your Honor, I think it was the next day. I don't have that in front of me. I'm sorry. It wasn't 48-plus hours. It was still in the snowbank right where his hand had just been not that long before, when he had fled from the police, which shows consciousness of guilt.
Could indicate whether when this gun was thrown in the snowbank, you know, that it's a high crime area, one way or the other?
I believe it was a playground. I don't believe there was any evidence that this was a place where they routinely find guns or anything like that was suggested. So that's the harmless error argument that goes to everything. And I'll turn then to the DNA, since that seems to be what most of the questions are about today. And I want to clarify that we are not arguing that this wasn't a search. Our argument is that under U.S. Supreme Court precedent that is cited in these cases from other jurisdictions, particularly Vermont and Iowa that I've cited, you don't need a warrant for every search that involves identification evidence. The Supreme Court has said, in appropriate circumstances, this is on page 16
of
my brief.
So, Mr. Raggetts, I understand that argument as to fingerprints, and certainly there's a lot of case law that supports your position in that regard. But it seems to me that there is a point, you know, to appellant's argument that a saliva sample, particularly one obtained by a buccal swab, is different. It does involve going into someone's mouth. Fingerprints doesn't involve that. I mean, we all leave our fingerprints all over the place all the time.
Right, but appellant's argument seems to be that any search requires probable cause or a specific exception. Right. And part of my point here is just that that's not true as a blanket matter. And I'm not aware of any case law that says fingerprinting isn't a search. Maybe there is some, but you can't just willy-nilly force people to give up their fingerprints. So that's where I think the Iowa and Vermont Supreme Court decisions are quite persuasive in their explanation of the U.S. Supreme Court precedent, what the Colorado court set out, and a test that's been widely used, where, yes, you need more than just probable cause to charge. We're not arguing that. That was CTL. But here you have more than that. You have this rule that says you need a finding that it will materially aid. So you've got not just probable cause to charge with a crime, you've got a judicial determination that this evidence will materially aid. And I disagree with
that. Materially aid is different from the probable cause that's required to support a warrant, correct?
It is. It's not the same language, but again, we know from...
Oh, it's not the same standard, is it, counsel?
Well, I think arguably it's a harder standard.
Go for it. Yep.
Probable cause just requires a fair probability. Here we need a finding that it will materially aid. Not there's a fair probability that it will materially aid, but that it will materially aid.
Aid in what?
I don't have the language here right here in front of me, but basically it's the same purpose of a search warrant, obviously, to determine whether this person committed the crime or whether we can eliminate this person. And appellant says, well, maybe it'll materially aid in a different way. But at least in this context, where you're looking for DNA on a gun, you're looking for evidence that's either going to inculpate or exculpate. There's no other option here. So at least in this context, it's hard to imagine what other purpose this could be that wouldn't meet the test. And appellants never argued here that we don't have probable cause to get this.
Cause to charge. I think they are asking whether.
No, I think he's not arguing that if they had gone for a warrant, they couldn't have got one.
Oh, I see.
He's just saying that they didn't jump through all the hoops, they didn't get the warrant. But the judge followed a rule here. So at a minimum, we've got good faith. I mean, if you can't rely on a rule created by the judicial branch, then good faith doesn't exist. It's much like relying on a published decision or arguably a statute even. But it's stronger than that because here we have something from the judicial branch saying, you can do this. The judge did it. That was good faith. There's also inevitable discovery. I've cited in my brief the JWK and Epler cases, which make clear that inevitable discovery applies to evidence of identity in a different way than it applies to physical evidence. I mean, you don't necessarily have inevitable discovery of a gun because if you came back later, the gun might have been gone.
So,
but his DNA was
remembering correctly. I thought you argued inevitable discovery only as to the hearsay. Am I wrong about that?
No. I'm sorry.
No, you must have argued it as to the DNA. Inevitable discovery in your
brief?
Well,
yes. And the judge essentially found inevitable discovery here in a slightly different context. And it's interesting because appellant's argument below wasn't Rule 902 is essentially unconstitutional. His argument below was, well, you withdrew this previous warrant, so now you can't get a new one, or you can't get the DNA through some other source. It's somehow sort of a fruit of the poisonous tree thing. And the judge rejected that, and that would also apply here, because identity evidence isn't going anywhere. That's the point of JWK and Epler. DNA wasn't going to change.
Do you believe that a buccal swab is an unreasonable intrusion?
I think it depends on the circumstances, and I think that's where the Colorado test is so important, because it's not unreasonable when you've got probable cause to charge with the crime and when the judge makes a finding that it will materially aid in the investigation. In this context, materially aid by either perhaps excluding appellant as a suspect, and then he can go, or leading to further investigation. So I think that under these cases from other jurisdictions I've cited, we don't have an unconstitutional search here. This is an issue of first impression. I think it might be appropriate for this court to issue a published decision on that because we need to know one way or the other.
What would you propose the syllabus point to be, Mr.?
I think it would be that, as with many other jurisdictions, the Colorado test should be applied to a Rule 902 search, and under that test, this clearly passes.
Mr. Regis, if I may, turn your attention to the hearsay issues here.
Please.
So two questions. You know, when I look at those statements, you know, that were played and read to the jury and the text messages and the voicemails, you know, tell me, what statement that she made beyond that two-way split was against her penal interest? Because I didn't read or that into it. And if just give me your best couple of examples, and that's my first part of my question. And the second part was the other, if not this hearsay exception here, these others, was did the state argue that at the district court below?
No, and just so I don't forget, let me address that argument first. Appellant has argued in his reply brief, we've waived that by now arguing below. Gruening clearly says we can make alternative arguments on appeal based on established facts. Gruening hasn't been overruled. Gruening has been cited numerous times by this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court. So we can make fallback arguments as long as there aren't additional facts needed. And there aren't here because we just are talking about these phone calls. So that's one point. The other point that kind of ties into that, and then I'll get back to your first question, is it's appellant who's forfeited an argument here because appellant never said, hey, Judge Byers, you need to redact this even more. What appellant argued below was none of this comes in. But appellant's conceded essentially on appeal that that's wrong. On page 11 of his brief, he acknowledges that some of this is appropriately in because it's appropriately self-incriminatory. So the argument made below is not before this court. There was no argument in front of Judge Byers. Put yourself in her shoes. She was never asked to further redact this. And she didn't need to do that sua sponte. So we do have forfeiture here, but it's by appellant, not by the state. And then as to the statements, appellant acknowledges that some of the statements, and again, I think this is a page 11 of his brief, some of the statements are sufficiently incriminatory because she indicates they're planning the crime, she did it, she had help. I think the key thing if you look at the case law is, are the statements blame-shifting or curry-favoring? And to the extent, and they're not, and to the extent they just aren't self-incriminatory, well, then they're not prejudicial. They're just context. And all of the statements here were necessary for context of what she's talking about. She's worried about him blaming her solely because he was able to ditch his gun.
So what do you think your best legal authority is for that argument, that those additional statements were necessary for context?
Your Honor, I haven't found any case law that says you have to go sentence by sentence through a statement.
I think it's a statement by statement.
Right. That's my point.
Is that different?
I think it is, because if you were going to go sentence by sentence, as I point out in my somewhat silly example in my footnote, if you take out the context, you can't tell what they're talking about. There has to be sentences in there that explain what all of this is referring to.
So, counsel, your footnote made some sense to me with regard to a question and answer scenario, which we certainly have here. We have a conversation going back and forth between at least many of these examples include that. I'm not quite sure I agree with you when it comes to the scope, the number of statements that were admitted in this regard. I mean, some of those could have been further redacted. I don't think that it's even reasonable to say they couldn't have been.
Oh no, my point is they appellant never asked them to be, for one.
I got your forfeiture argument. Okay. I understand it. I'm not sure I agree with it, but go ahead.
Right. So Judge Byers was never asked to do that. And to the extent that they aren't self-incriminatory, well, then they're also harmless. But my argument, again, is they're all necessary for context, explaining she's talking to her brother, she's saying she had help.
You don't have case law supporting you on that, is that right?
Well, there isn't a case law that says, again, it's not statement by statement, it's sentence by sentence.
Well, there's case law saying it's inappropriate for a district court with this hearsay exception to simply allow a narrative to be presented to the court. That's not it, which sounds a lot like context to me, but go ahead.
Well, I think the point is you can't sneak in blame shifting or currying favor just because it's all part of one big statement. But again, they've never said there was any blame shifting or curry favoring here, and blame spreading isn't a concept recognized by the case law. They've never said any of that was here and should have been taken out. Everything here is, I did it, we did it together, I'm worried about him blaming me because he was able to ditch his gun. So when you take it all together, there's nothing that runs afoul of the case law, which focuses on blame shifting and curry favoring. And I'm sorry, I've gone over my time, unless the court, please.
I believe Judge Justin has a question.
I just had a follow-up question. You said recently, if it's not incriminating, it's not prejudicial. And I just wasn't following that, because mm-hmm. it could not be incriminating necessarily to her, but still prejudicial to the appellant here, right?
Well, right. I think what they were saying is, well, her brother's statements shouldn't have come in because he wasn't unavailable. But nothing her brother's statements... None of her brother's statements incriminated him either. So certainly there could be certain circumstances where she is trying to shift blame or do something that's incriminating to him but not to her, but there's no allegation there's anything like that here. So to the extent they're just saying you should have gone sentence by sentence and taken out everything that wasn't literally self-incriminating, they haven't identified anything, I guess, in that category that incriminates him but not her, since she's always saying they did it together. That should have been taken out, and that but for that, you wouldn't have had the verdict here because of the great impact it would have had on the verdict. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Butler, you'll have the last word, sir. You're welcome.
So if you don't mind, Mr. Butler, I'd really appreciate it if you'd address the inevitable.
Sure. So inevitable discovery is backwards here. Mm-hmm. This search was supposed to be the inevitable discovery that cured the bad search warrant. But the issue here is whether this search itself was constitutional. The state says, I think I heard counsel say, we're not claiming that there wasn't probable cause, or we're not claiming they couldn't have gotten a warrant or something. We are claiming that, because they did get a warrant, and it was unconstitutional. So they already tried that. Then they tried this to make up for the fact that that was bad. So there's no claim that If this one was also bad, then they would have gone and gotten a second warrant. But this one, unlike the first one, would have been based on probable cause and would have been constitutional. There's been no argument like that. There was no argument like that at the district court. If they wanted a warrant, they could have gone and gotten a second warrant to fix the first one. They didn't. So this was supposed to be the inevitable discovery, but this itself is unconstitutional. So it doesn't work. I wanted to answer Judge Connolly's question about the record. The arrest of Mr. Steeprock and the co-defendant was on December 31st. That's on page 95 of the transcript. The gun was found on January 2nd. That's on page 113 of the transcript. So a few days there in between. Not only was there a few days in between, but those January 31st and January 2nd was hours of searches by multiple police officers before that gun was found. Including January 31st, they're there for a really long time, and no one, including where Mr. Steeprock was arrested, and no one finds the gun, including with the dog, explosive dog, gun dog, whatever. But
in all fairness, there is a lot of snow in Duluth.
There is a lot, that's true, but his hand was in the snowbank. And the arresting officer saw that. So it's not like they didn't know where to look. The point is,
it
counsel
does appear
said,
to be the same snowbank, though, right? I appreciate all of this circumstantial evidence, but it's pretty important in the sense that this is a weapon that by ballistics has been identified to have produced.
That's why the DNA evidence is so important, Your Honor. Counsel said the DNA evidence doesn't matter because he threw the snowbank gun. It was obvious it was his gun. And I think, Judge Bradfield, you asked, somebody asked, who saw him throw the gun? Judge Connolly, maybe. And the answer is nobody. The answer is the gun was found after Alexia Cutbank called the person who lives in that apartment complex and said where she was hiding out and said something about, oh, I think he dumped the gun. You better go look for that gun. And then suddenly, lo and behold, there's a gun. And it's got his DNA on it. So it doesn't matter at this trial. It doesn't matter how it got there because it's got his DNA on it. But that's the impact of the DNA, is that it makes it seem like it doesn't, you know, it links it to him.
You're right, yes. I mean, I'm not going to say with a straight face the DNA didn't help the state. However, you know, a lot of times, in a lot of the felon in possession cases, you know, the typical testimony from the BCA person is, well, you never find DNA in a gun.
Yep.
And, you know, a lot of times they're still convicted. So my question is this. If you had no DNA, but you had the gun in the snowbank, you had two of the statements, let's say for the sake of argument, you had two of the statements which are against her interest. You had the fleeing. Isn't that, I'm not going to say overwhelming evidence, but wouldn't that be enough to convict?
If that was the trial evidence that was presented at this trial, if that had all been presented, that would probably be sufficient had I raised on appeal a constitutional sufficiency analysis. I agree. That is not the test.
The question, but I got it, believe me. Your argument is the DNA did have an impact because, oh my God, DNA, you know.
Right. In this case, the BCA scientist said, we did find DNA.
Yeah.
And DNA is rock solid. And DNA is unimpeachable. The prosecutor's closing argument is basically, even the defense conceded the DNA was proper for Miss Cutbank on Miss Cutbank's gun. And the prosecutor said, that's inconsistent. You can't say this one's, you know, okay, but this one's not. It's the same test. So in this case, it's not like the felon in possession cases, because in this case, they did have the DNA. One final point, my last 12 seconds, if I may. Page 350 of the transcript, which is at the trial when the state is offering these hearsay statements, the defense objects. The judge says, any objection to these hearsay statements coming in? And the defendant says, yes, I object for our previously stated reasons.
Is a blanket objection enough, though, counsel, after the redactions?
For the previously stated reasons, yeah. You don't have to stand there after having 50 pages of pretrial litigation over these statements in which the defense, yes, said none of it should come in. The fact that on appeal, I can say, well, look, I'm not going to bang my head against the wall and say the trial judge abused her discretion by admitting that first statement where Ms. Cutbank says to her brother something like, I'm, you know, words to the effect of, I'm going to go kill that guy. Whatever, that's fine. I'm not going to say that's an abuse of discretion. I will say it's an abuse of discretion to say call number three comes in, because nothing there is incriminating to Ms. Cutbank, and all of it is incriminating to my client.
And you're telling me that in your view, in terms of preservation of error, it did not fall to the defendant to note that difference during the trial?
No, it's the state is the proponent of the evidence. Yeah. State bears the burden. That all the defendant, I agree, if the defendant says no objection, we're here in plain error land. If the defendant says I want it in, we're here in plain error land. If the defendant says let's redact three things and then I'm good with the rest of it, we're here in plain error land. None of that happened. And at trial, the defendant said, I object to this. I object to all of this. That's preservation.
I did have two more questions. So what about Mr. Ricketts's argument about context? I mean, I understand the Supreme Court has said, you know, you've got to parse it and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, in looking at, and again, this is my interpretation of the, you know, in reading it all, the gist of it to me was, hey, you know, she's talking to her brother, and well, you know, we may have problems now. Gee, what should we do? And again, those are my words, not yours. And it was like, you know, my interpretation was, well, should we off him or do something else? Because now, you know, he may get off and I may get stuck. And, you know, you don't get that if you, well, you know, I'm going to throw out this sentence but not that sentence. I mean, and I understand it's a little different, but what about that?
I agree that context matters. So I agree that you can't look at things in a vacuum. So when she says taco, it's fair to say that what she's based on the rest of the conversation, what she's really saying is gun. I get that. But counsel's example, and I think Judge Jessen's question hit the nail on the head here, context matters if we're talking about question, answer. Then the jury needs to hear the question in order for the answer to make sense. That's context. That third call, which is the worst one for my client, because the one in which she says, for example, he put a little gun to my head and said, you don't want no smoke. That's just her accusing him of putting a gun to her head. That is not incriminating against her in any way, with any context. So the other thing you can't do with context is change the words. And so I think you said, Judge Connolly, you know, this was how you interpreted it, but it's not what she said. So we're looking at what she said. What did she say? And again, we looked back to the plain language of the rule. Is it so incriminating that no reasonable person would say it if it's not true? That is different than would it be relevant at a prosecution of Ms. Cutbank. If Ms. Cutbank had gone on trial, I agree, the state could play all of these statements, because they won't be hearsay against her, they're statements of a party opponent, and they're relevant. They're generally relevant. No problem. That's not what this rule is. This rule is a much higher bar than that.
And my last question is, you know, Mr. Ricketts suggested, as to the Rule 9 issue, that it might be worthy of a presidential opinion. Do you agree, and what do you think the syllabus point should be if you think we should publish?
Sure. I don't have a particular preference on whether you publish, make it precedential or not. I agree that the DNA thing seems to be a question of first impression, so you could consider that. The syllabus point for the DNA issue is, very simply, taking a buccal swab requires a probable cause-based search warrant, perhaps something like as discussed in Rule 9, which Rule 9 itself says subject to constitutional limitations. And Rule 9 says as long as the intrusion is not unreasonable, that's right in the rule. So something along those lines, if you want to separate out, you know, Judge Bratfeld and I were talking about this, you know, separating out one type of search from another or one type of action from another, you could say something like that. I think you could also say, look, the hearsay alone is prejudicial, and the DNA is really just CTL, which you've already published, and tells district courts what to do. So that would be perfectly acceptable as well.
Thank you. Seeing no more further questions, the matter is submitted. We will issue our decision in 90 days. Thank you, Mr. Butler. Thank you, Mr.
I guess the only other thing is if you're going to distinguish CTL, that might be worth publishing because courts are going to follow CTL otherwise.
Thank you. Mr. Raggetts, please give my warmest regards to Mr. Stockmeyer.
I will.
Thank you. Thank you very much.